Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, taking you on another journey of consumer choice on this December 24, 2020. It's Christmas Eve, a very special Christmas Eve actually this year. In many places, families are not allowed to come together due to the COVID-19 pandemic. In any way, I hope you're spending a good time this evening in whatever capacity or constellation. They haven't banned eggnog just yet, so I'll let you indulge in any consumption you like. We're all about choices here at the Consumer Podcast. As a reminder for our listeners, the CCC has three different podcast programs you can subscribe to. This is, of course, the program you're listening to right now, Consumer, which focuses on European consumer topics. Then there is Consumer Choice Radio, hosted by my colleagues Jarl Sawski and David Clement, broadcasting every Saturday, also on the Big Talker radio station in North Carolina across the pond. And there is Consumer Choice Center Cast, which is where we upload recent interviews or audio material that we produce for our current campaigns. Do make sure to subscribe to these wherever you listen to podcasts. My guest on the show this week is Adam Barter, who is the director of Epicenter, the European Policy Information Center. We will be talking about the new rule of law conditionality in the EU budget. Listeners of last week's show will know that this is something that my guest Peter Klepper had already mentioned. But this week, we'll make a deep dive into the reasons behind this new mechanism. But all of that later on. 2021 is the European Year of Rail. In the last week's plenary session of the European Parliament, the three institutions of the EU congratulated themselves on this declaration. The European Council says on its website, and I quote, "The Year of Rail will promote railways as a sustainable, innovative, and safe mode of transport, which is capable of guaranteeing essential services even during unexpected crises. This has been shown by the strategic role played by rail in maintaining crucial connections during the COVID-19 pandemic for the transport both of people and of essential goods." End of quote. Here's EU Transport Commissioner Valéan from Romania laying out why we're having this European Year of Rail next year.
The European Year of Rail underlines the importance that this commission attaches to meeting the Green Deal objectives for transport, including a 90% reduction in transport emissions by 2050. Rail also features prominently in our new sustainable and smart mobility strategy. If the strategy is our recipe for a modern future-proof mobility system, rail is certainly one of its main ingredients. I want to stress three aspects. First, the debates and discussions during next year will drive our work to get more passengers and goods using rail. As you know, in 2021, we'll present initiatives targeting both. We'll also launch a study on the feasibility of creating a rail connectivity index that shows the potential of rail to compete with other transport modes.
In the European Parliament debate, there was an interesting contribution by a German Liberal Democrat member of the European Parliament, Jan-Christoph Oettingen, who raised the issue of rail competition.
We also need digital ticketing, that's mentioned in the document, but we also need competition on the rails. We see that wherever there is competition, more people get better services, more people use rail. Look at the situation in Italy, for example. That's exactly what needs to be done. At the moment, the state is using protectionism for its own state-owned companies rather than promoting competition.
I think that's a very important point. In many EU countries, you have these legacy actors, state-owned and state-run rail companies that are terribly inefficient and that only survive because of subsidies and because alternative methods of transport are made harder to access. I mean, in every way, France is a good example of this phenomenon. The state-owned company SNCF is the only actor on the market. Well, European competition is now open, but with all the benefits SNCF received from being a state-owned company, it makes it very difficult to be a private competitor. And it does not provide a good service. The only reason SNCF is still a viable choice is because France constantly increases flight prices and petrol prices, which, by the way, makes a road trip through France very expensive. It is very much a self-fulfilling prophecy there. Rail is good because we've punished all the alternatives to it. But as Mr. Oettingen was saying earlier, there is a different way to do it, and he mentions the example of Italy. The Consumer Choice Center in 2018 published an interesting read that I recommend to you called The Benefits of Railway Competition, The Case of Italy. You can find this paper under the publications section at consumerchoicecenter.org. I asked my Italian colleague Luca Bertoletti, who co-authored the said policy note, to explain to me what the benefits of the Italian railway market system are. And this is what he told me.
Italy, incredible, was able to actually have a really strong competition on the railways market. From things we started around the end of the year 2000, so around 2010, 2011, with a company named ArenaWays. That company failed after less than 1 year because the Italian state-owned railways, Ferrovie dello Stato, did everything to destroy it. Made the tracks impossible for them, more expensive. And that was really bad. That was really, really bad. And that changed, actually, after a couple of years, when the new government realized that building high-speed tracks, it was way too expensive for just Ferrovie dello Stato Trenitalia. So they opened the market to new competitors. One of these was Italo Treno, which started with a pool of Italian train operators, actually, and shareholders. And now it's owned by a very, very big American fund. Italo and Trenitalia, which is the Italian state-owned division, compete on the same tracks, compete on price and on services offered to people. We can consider Italy the only market which is completely open to competitors.
That was my colleague Luca Bertoletti from the Consumer Choice Center filling you in on Italian rail competition. I like the rail market in Italy, and to be honest, I didn't know much about their rail network until I tried it myself a few years ago. And I think private rail operators are brilliant. So I think during the European Year of Rail 2021, European governments should look more closely at creating a more competitive market through further liberalization, for instance, than what is currently required under EU law, I mean, or through privatizing their local supplier. In order to make immediate competition a success, governments should also liberalize the local long-distance bus market, as France and Germany have done. You see all these private bus companies, for instance, like Flixbus, and I think they provide a great service and a great alternative compared to, for instance, taking a flight or taking a train. Another issue I wanted to raise with you is that of illicit trade. Tomorrow is Christmas Day, so many of you will have bought and will receive Christmas presents. But not all products are automatically safe just because they are nicely wrapped. In fact, an awful lot of products in Europe are counterfeit. In January this year, a cargo ship in Italy went up in flames due to shipping containers filled with counterfeit lithium batteries, which were supposed to be sold in Europe, so very dangerous there. The risk is exceptionally high for consumers. Because when you think of counterfeit products, you are thinking of something that for you is harmless, like a fake designer handbag. But when it comes to children's toys, electronics, or food products, you should be exceptionally careful. The word illicit trade describes all the economic exchange of illegal goods. Illicit trade can describe the market of illegal drugs, but it can also mean illegally traded products. So the difference is important here. If I sell you heroin, that's an illegal trade because the product is illegal and having the product is also illegal. If I sell you fake designer shoes, the act of me having fake shoes is not illegal in every country, especially not if I was not aware that they are fake, but the product is still illegal. The illicit trade I'm referring to here is the second one. These are products that are perfectly legal within themselves, in so far that, for instance, shoes are legal, but they are still not traded on a legal market. This illicit trade is not just an issue in Europe. Here's a report by CNBC about illicit trade in the United States.
Seizures of counterfeit products at U.S. borders have increased tenfold over the past two decades. The total value of seized goods, if they'd been real, reached nearly $1.4 billion in 2018. Most are coming from mainland China or Hong Kong.
The Chinese counterfeiters pop up so fast, The moment you take them down, another one pops up.
The rise of e-commerce has fueled counterfeiting around the world. Amazon said it blocked more than 3 billion suspected fake listings from its marketplace in 2018.
International e-commerce sellers must step up and do more.
The economic cost of counterfeiting is mounting. The OECD says fake goods account for more than 3% of all global trade, while some estimate the sale of illicit products could result in more than 5.4 million net job losses worldwide by 2022.
We're talking about a massive scale that is in itself a large chunk of the global economy. The CCC held a webinar in October where we had two experts talk about the threat of illicit trade. Here's Jeff Hardy, who is the Director General of the Transnational Alliance to Combat Illicit Trade, trying to visualize how up to date these illegal traders are.
You know, the other big observation that probably most everyday people are familiar with is the PPE. There was a surge in fake masks, as you can imagine, and hand sanitizers and anything that had to do with, you know, a human being trying to protect themselves from the virus. And organizations like Europol, for example, had charted the numbers. You know, the offerings on illicit platforms skyrocketed by thousands of percentages, you know, as people scrambled to try to protect themselves. You know, I think just, you know, looking into the future, what we're going to see is as remedies start to become available, this is where the illicit traders and counterfeiters are going to move next, you know, playing on fears.
By the way, you could find the entire webinar on our Consumer Choice Center YouTube channel. So the question is, how can you deal with this problem? Two important points. If you have scammers, so people who tell you that the product is real, but they end up selling you a fake one, that is a law enforcement issue where we need to make it as cheap as possible for people to go to court. To me, that's very clear. The same goes for people who add another layer of criminal offense on top by selling you dangerous or even poisonous products. So we should increase existing penalties for illicit trade. That's very clear to me. The other point is that of the availability of products. When you have complete prohibition on a product, you make it very profitable for someone to fake it. We all know this. We all know this to be true. But it is also true of products that we are continuously making more expensive. If consumers really want a product, they will try to get it. And if we tax products, they will enter the illicit market. So for products like clothing, this costs jobs. But for products such as medicine, it costs lives. But in other news then, on January 1st, the EU's harmonized drone usage rules will come into practice. If you are using drones for private use, or if you're a filmmaker needing it to record weddings and so on, chances are that your national rules will be changing on the 1st of January. So you will need different certifications, and you will need to understand how you can use your drone safely. By the way, you can find all these changes on the website of the European Union Aviation Safety Agency on easa.europa.eu. See, I don't know what regulators have come up with. I'm just giving you the news here, the update here. My general rule with drones is don't film people if they don't want to be filmed. Practice enough so you don't crash. And bring me those home deliveries because that is really cool to get that via drone. Anyway, let's continue with less policy but more politics. My guest this week is Adam Barter, the director of the European Policy Information Center, the acronym being the catchy Epicenter. He is Hungarian, thus double qualified for what I've been asking him. I asked him about the incoming rule of law conditionality for the EU budget and why Poland and Hungary were so upset over the initial proposal. Let's see if we were able to decrypt it for your ears. What is this rule of law conditionality? What is the European Union trying to do here?
It's very much a political question, I think. The EU recognized that a lot of the cohesion funds have been misused by national governments in the past. Olaf, the European Anti-Fraud Office, couldn't really do much about it. And there are really systematic problems in some of the member states about how some of these EU funds are being used. So better late than never, the EU caught up after a while and tried to implement some further processes how it might stop the misuse of such funds. it's clearly directed against some of the EU member states, most notably Hungary and Poland. But there have been several other EU member states, Slovakia, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, where EU funds have been systematically misused in the past. So now they're trying to link the rule of law, basically the independence of judiciary, political competition, the respect for private property to the redistribution of EU funds. How it will work, that's a very good question. I don't really know it yet. Some are more hopeful than others, but I think it's a good first step to try to control the redistribution of EU funds in a stricter way in the future.
Yeah, so we don't exactly know how it's going to work. And this has been a criticism as well, that it's very unclear how this is going to be decided. In your view, in what way can it even be effective? Like how, like what percentage of EU funds would you have to scrap for any government to even react to this? Because if it's a low amount, well, then it's purely symbolic. If it's a large amount, then you're risking that these countries will say, well, I mean, there's no point in staying in the European Union. So what do you think is the most efficient tool here?
I mean, purely from a national perspective, the main advantage of being part of the EU is not to receive these cohesion funds or not to receive these subsidies from Brussels. The main advantage is really being part of the single market. And that's what a lot of people forget when we are discussing these issues, that it's greatly beneficial for the politicians who are in charge of redistributing these funds nationally. But purely from a citizen's perspective, the fact that there is free trade within the EU matters significantly more for my prosperity than the fact that I might be eligible to receive some EU cohesion funds. So the main problem with the distribution in the past wasn't that it didn't benefit citizens too much. To a level, it actually did. The big problem was that it benefited some corrupt political elites and some oligarchs in tremendous ways. I'm more than convinced that if Hungary were not part of the EU in the last basically almost 20 years now, then the Orbán government couldn't have kept up its popularity in the last 10 years. So effectively, these EU subsidies that were dispersed amongst Orbán-friendly oligarchs here in Hungary helped to maintain the popularity of the government. And the same thing applies to Poland. It wasn't really about how the money benefited the citizens. It was really about how the money benefited the political and economic elites. And that might change somewhat in the future, thanks to this rule of law mechanism. But at the moment, I think it's pretty hard to judge, to be fair.
How important are the definitions here? I know that Hungary has responded to this whole discussion and said, well, I mean, as long as we don't have an exact definition of what the rule of law even represents, we can't really act on it. Do we have clear definitions? Who's supposed to establish them? Does Hungary have a point here, or is this really just trying to stall?
Probably both. The rule of law in itself is a very, very broad concept, and in academia, people are constantly discussing what it means. But to be fair to the EU, I think they try to define it reasonably well. I think they define it by referring to the Treaty of the European Union, Article 2, and whatever that includes is going to be controlled by the European Commission. So it's not some incredibly detached academic concept as some in the Hungarian or Polish government tried to claim during the negotiation process. It's actually a pretty clearly defined set of rules that the EU is trying to refer to. But obviously checking it is not going to be easy. So I don't really have a problem with the definition. I have skepticism towards how the European Commission will be able to enforce these rules in the future. And it's not just the European Commission. The European Court of Justice will definitely play a role. The Venice Commission will definitely play a role. So it's a set of EU and non-EU institutions that will look at all the member states, not just the problematic ones, when it comes to these enforcements. But obviously that takes a long, long time. So I don't expect any major changes in 2021, especially because the two problematic governments of Poland and Hungary managed to achieve a compromise and say that they want to hear from the ECJ first, whether this is something compatible with EU legislation. And once they hear back from the ECJ, which might take a year or even more, then enforcement can properly happen through the European Commission. But we're going to have elections in Hungary in 2022. And before these elections, I don't think anything else will happen. So from a purely political perspective, that compromise was pretty beneficial to the Hungarian government, at least.
For those in the EU bubble, this, of course, is a very big topic. But tell us, on the ground in Hungary, is this actually that broad of a conversation? Does it influence Hungarian politics that much?
Corruption is a big political issue in Hungary. Everyone knows that there is a lot of high-level corruption, but people are very used to the low-level day-to-day corruption, just paying off the doctor to get better treatments and the like. So I think there is a strong political feeling that people from all sorts of political backgrounds do want to limit corruption, and they get pretty upset when they see the childhood friend of Orban becoming a billionaire in a very short period of time and earning more money than Mark Zuckerberg in 2019, which you could say is a pretty big achievement for a Hungarian oligarch. So corruption is a big issue on the ground, and anything that basically helps to limit corruption in some way is perceived pretty well by opposition forces. And anything that seems to limit the maneuvering room of the Orban government is also perceived very strongly by pro-government voters. So this was presented in the mainstream pro-government media as something that will limit national sovereignty, as something imposed upon the Hungarian people, and as something that has to do with the EU being a pro-globalist, pro-Soros force. So it wasn't really about the actual content of the rule of law mechanism, but basically about national sovereignty versus globalist institutions.
What you mentioned about the political consequences, you know, the political reactions to it, we might actually see that in other countries as well. If you started to apply this to Malta, I'm pretty sure the Social Democrats will feel very strongly about it as well. Also, if you take it as an example, well, the UK is not a member anymore, but the UK just implemented very strict rules without any parliament oversight whatsoever, without any parliament vote. In France, we have this whole debate about police brutality. Other countries might be the target of this mechanism. And I fear that it is now a convenient mechanism to go after two countries specifically. But if it were to touch on the bigger members, we would very quickly water it down. Do you see this as well as a problem?
I mean, these double standards have often been claimed by the Polish and Hungarian government that, hey, we are often targeted by institutions, but look at France, look at Germany. They also have their own issues and they're not being targeted by the European Commission. There might be some limited truth to it, to be fair. I think this political debate was very much about two EU member states, but this was beneficial for those two EU member states involved. And this was purposefully designed to be around them. They announced a veto. They announced that they're fighting against the Brussels bureaucrats. So it was beneficial for them. And it was also beneficial for some in the Brussels bubble who could be seen as fighting the autocrats in the East. You're completely right. If it would be expanded further and actually applied to not just Hungary and Poland, but also other EU member states that have significant issues when it comes to judicial independence or the freedom of the press. You mentioned Malta. I think Malta was definitely one of the underreported stories when it came to the freedom of the press and judicial independence. But the big difference is timing and the period that we're talking about. In Poland, we're talking about 5 years already. In Hungary, we're talking about 10 years. Whereas a lot of the other corrupt, autocratic-leaning political leaders in other countries, they haven't been around for so long. And there is a lot more political competition going on in other countries than in Poland and Hungary. So I acknowledge a lot of the problems that you have mentioned. I certainly don't want to pretend that they are not issues that concern me from a pro-individual freedom perspective. But I think it matters whether you have been in power for 10 years and you managed to reshape every single political institution in your country, or whether you're just trying to do it and you're very much at the beginning of the process. I think it's good if this rule of law mechanism manages to stop that early on in the process in other European countries. But the issue with Poland and Hungary was that we're so far down the line, and Hungary especially. I mean, what Orbán manages to achieve in Hungary in terms of economic impact and political powers is really uncomparable to any other European country, including Poland, to be frank. I mean, the Polish government has very similar ideas, but they were met by a lot more resistance locally than in Hungary. So ideally, exactly what you say would happen. This would be enforced in all EU member states to equal measure. But practically, this debate has been really centered around two of the EU member states.
Last question. Do you have any, now you, for the holidays, you are back in Hungary. Usually you spend most of your time in the UK. Now, when you see your country, when you talk to people, I mean, overall, you sound very pessimistic. Do you have any optimism left for the country? Do you think that there are positive changes coming?
Well, in the long term, of course, I do think so. I mean, the communists didn't manage to stay in power. The fascists didn't manage to stay in power. But it matters whether we're talking about 20 years or whether we're talking about 40 years or whether, you know, there will be elections in 2022 in Hungary. And there might be a chance that even in such circumstances with a united opposition who are very, very different. I mean, the united opposition includes the socialists, it includes basically far right or formerly far right political parties, it includes liberals, it includes Greens, but they kind of realized that, yeah, the main enemy to restore the foundations of liberal democracy is now Orbán and his political party. So they did unite, at least on paper. They're going to be running in the elections together. So that might give them more of a chance to have a shot. But to be fair, I mean, the media landscape is completely in the hands of Orbán. The economic power is completely in his hands. The Hungarian parliament is just a nice building, but there's literally no political discussions happening in there. So it's a completely toothless and useless institution, to be frank. So that will require a lot of support from the citizenry. So even if the opposition wins with 52 to 48, percent, they won't be able to manage the one-party constitution to be changed. They won't be able to get rid of the political appointees in the judiciary. They won't be able to have an impact on the media landscape. So in Slovakia, a couple of years, such a united opposition actually won. And then within a year, the government collapsed because there were so many political parties and so many challenges ahead of them that they couldn't manage. So I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I think it requires a lot of societal change to acknowledge that this has not been the way towards prosperity. This has not been the way towards more individual freedom. And we need to look at something completely different than the last 10 years. Otherwise, Hungary is going to be just falling behind all of its neighbors. and will not have the same kind of prosperity and same kind of liberties that many in the EU do enjoy.
And that concludes this episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. Make sure to follow the Consumer Choice Center on Instagram. We have updated graphics, consumer information, and as soon as we're back to travel, faces that will be presentable and representing you at conferences around the globe. Thank you so much for listening. I'm your host, Bill Woods. See you Thursday. You have to learn.